This is Sign Language with Bruce Williams and Doc Goldstein.
Hi, and welcome to episode 171 of Sign Language. This is Bruce Williams from signlanguagepodcast.com.
And this is Doc Goldstein. Good morning.
How are you, Doc?
I'm good. Finally here, you know. Better late than never, right?
Mate, as you said, you were engrossed in a mix, and I completely understand what that's like. I know that when I get into that headspace when I'm mixing, I hate any kind of intrusion because it takes you out of the zone.
Right. Well, Einstein was wrong. You don't have to go to the speed of light for time to change. You know,
oh yeah.
Two things can make time change: either working out at the gym and where time slows down. You know,
yep.
Because you just, you know, to count to 1 to 15 seems like it takes 3 hours.
Yeah.
Or, or when you're mixing, time dilates the other direction because time just goes by. You know, so
totally. Do you know what? There's a guy, an author from the States, a guy called Mark Manson, and I've been following his writings, and he had a bestseller last year with a book quite mischievously called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, which is a fantastic book. And I remember one of the first pieces of his writing that I stumbled across and which sort of got me addicted to reading his stuff was the seven questions that you should ask yourself to help define you know where your life was headed. And one of the questions was, what activity makes you forget to eat and poop? And he said, whatever that thing is, that's what you should be doing with your life. And I thought, yeah, that is so me and mixing, you know, because when it comes to mixing, you get engrossed in a mix, and as you say, time just completely runs away from you, and you quite easily forget to eat and poop.
Well, I never forget to eat.
Anyway, this episode, yes, we are going to get onto compression, but there was a couple of things I wanted to cover before we got to that. One was with all the recent Black Friday and Cyber Monday sales from all the software companies, the plug-in companies and all that kind of stuff, and with me already having some Waves plugins in my kit bag, one of the things that I saw pop up was Waves doing a special price on the Abbey Road EMI TG12345 channel strip. And one of the things that grabbed me was that the banner ad, you know, had "as used by the Beatles." And I got thinking about it and I thought, why the hell would we care? I mean, yes, the Beatles had a massive influence on, you know, popular music and, you know, and early rock music. And yes, we hold them in high esteem for their contribution to, you know, the art of music, you know, in general. But it made me think about photography and how we as photographers get really frustrated when people say, oh, your photos are amazing. You must have a really good camera, right? Because the insinuation is in that comment, as, you know, uninformed as it is that it's the camera that does the magic. And it's not the camera that does the magic. It's the wetware behind the camera that does the magic.
Right. Now, so you have the skills, not the camera, right?
Exactly. You can put a very basic camera in the hands of a professional and they will produce stunning images. And the reverse of that is you can put the top of the line, you know, DSLR with all the bells and whistles and the best zoom lenses and every bit of paraphernalia that comes along with that in the hands of a complete amateur, and they will produce amateurish crap with it.
Well, I mean, that's evident by the fact that anybody can buy a workstation now, and most of what they reproduce is drivel in any style of music.
Yeah.
You know, when I was younger, you know, I found out the hard way that having a Gretsch in my hands did not make me sound like George.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what kind of got me onto this theme was, like, why do I care if this, you know, EMI channel strip was used by the Beatles? You know, just because you put this, you know, plug-in in the kit bag of any bedroom engineer or musician for that matter, isn't going to necessarily make you sound like the Beatles.
Yes, I agree. But on the other hand, being a, you know, the Beatles changed my life when I saw them on Ed Sullivan. It totally changed my career path. I was, I don't know, 14. Right. I was maybe 13 or 14.
Wow.
And I wanted to be a scientist, you know. And
yeah, right.
Instead, I went down the tubes. But having said all that, and as true as it is, I wouldn't mind having that plug in.
sure. But I guess what I was getting at was just that, you know, just because it was used by someone who left an indelible stamp on the history of popular music doesn't mean that because you use it, you will necessarily leave the same stamp on the history of popular music.
Well, but if you want to sound,
I was going,
I don't disagree. I think if you want to sound like Jeff Emmerich, you have to be Jeff Emmerich, you know?
Yeah.
And he's tall, so I can never be Jeff Emmerich. You know, right. I had the pleasure of meeting him, and he's tall, man. He's, you know, he right. should play basketball in his spare time, honest.
Right. Okay. Anyway, so I thought that was an interesting little side note. The other thing, this is something I came across in the last couple of weeks, and admittedly, we are a couple of weeks behind schedule. We didn't mean for it to be a month between episodes. It's just Doc and I had differing schedules that sort of made it the last couple of weekends a bit difficult to record. But this was something I came across on medium.com, and it's all about the future of audio and how that pertains to the blockchain. Now, for those who are not familiar with blockchain technology, you've probably heard of Bitcoin by now and some of the other cryptocurrencies like Ethereum. All of these cryptocurrencies are built on blockchain technology. And what blockchain promises, and this is going to be an interesting technology to watch over the next 10 years, is with our current paradigm of digital technology. If I have, I saw this explained beautifully in a different blog post, which I should try and find. Basically, it said, you know, in the analog world, in the physical world, if Doc and I were sitting side by side and I've got an apple and I give the apple to Doc, then there's no question as to where the apple is. It's with Doc now. And Doc can do what he likes with it. He can either eat it or he can give it to somebody else, but there's only ever one apple. But in the digital realm, if I send Doc a digital version of an apple, a JPEG, that doesn't mean that Doc has the only copy of the JPEG. I could have emailed it to 100 other people. And that is a problem for copyright owners, you know, people who have intellectual property interests in, you know, any form of digital media, whether it be music or movies or television shows. This idea that once something is digitized, it can be copied and copied and copied, and there's no loss in quality every time you copy it, and there's no way to stop the copying process. What the blockchain technology means is that digital assets can be transferred to another party, but that is the only place those digital assets will exist. So this technology potentially has massive ramifications for copyright ownership in the future, in that the content creator will have much more control over the distribution of digital property, whether that, you know, like I said, whether it's music, movies, TV, whatever. So it's going to be a very interesting space. I don't claim to know everything there is to know about it, but I'm going to put a link in the show notes to this article on medium.com about where this stuff's going. Have you had much experience with blockchain or cryptocurrencies, Doc?
I've had zero experience with that.
Right. Okay. I bought some Bitcoin about 3 months ago when it was trading at $5,000 Australian, and it's now $15,000 Australian. It's tripled in 3 months.
Wow. That's lunch is on you, buddy.
Yeah, I wish I'd bought more than I did. because I was just dipping my toes in the waters of cryptocurrencies, I thought I'm just gonna put a tiny little amount in there and just, you know, try and get an understanding for what these cryptocurrencies are all about. And I've just watched it go up and up and up and up, and I'm kind of going, wow, and wishing that I'd put a whole heap more into it, you know.
Wow.
So anyway.
I don't know enough about it to take a chance like that. You know, it'd be like, to me, like betting, it'd be like betting on a junk stock, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. For sure. And the interesting thing about the cryptocurrencies is that you've got people who are very bullish on it, who are saying that even at, it's around about 11,000 US today, but they're saying that, you know, 5 years from now, it'll be $1 million a coin. So those are the bears. Sorry, those are the bulls. You also have some bears who are saying, "Nah, this is a fad. It's like the tulips in Holland in the 1600s, and it's all going to come crashing down to nothing, you know, overnight." So I don't know. I really don't know. But anyway, we're getting way off topic now. But anyway,
that's all right.
That link will be there for anyone that wants to read up on what these guys are promising with regards, you know, maintaining a control over the distribution of, you know, artistic assets in the digital world using blockchain technology. It's an interesting read and certainly something I'll be following. And as that technology develops, hopefully we can come back and discuss it more in the future.
So can you buy just a little piece of a Bitcoin since it's so pricey
yes.
now?
Yes, you can. You can. So I only bought $100 Australian worth, you know, like I said, I wasn't prepared to sink a massive amount in because I didn't know enough about it at the time. And I thought at the time, if I lose $100, it's not the end of the world. That was something I was prepared to take a gamble with. And I thought if it, you know, goes to nothing, then I'm really not that worse off because, you know, I could easily go and spend $100 on a couple of pieces of vinyl. But having watched it triple in 3 months, I'm kind of like, wow, why didn't I put a few grand into it, you know? But anyway.
Mm. Well, I hear you.
All right. So let's get on to a discussion of compression. Where do we start, Doc?
Well, we start by promising the listeners that we'll try not to put them to sleep and cause them to lapse into unconsciousness with this constant pedantic drivel about compression. I mean, I think we'll try to answer some questions, but I don't, you know, we could spend, you know, 5 podcasts on compression, and we're not going to do that, right? Because we've already decided that we just assume not bore everybody who doesn't care about it. So I have a few places to start. I sent you an email or a text, I don't remember which, about where I listed some stuff. And I'll start there. Like I talked about, you know, some of the things I listed had to do with, well, is this compressor, is it a plug-in? Is it hardware? If it's hardware, is it vacuum tube? And, you know, does it use a peak gain cell? Is it RMS level detection? All these things. And they're all different. And they all can be good and bad. So let me just start out with something that I think is true of all equipment and or software. We already talked about the fact that a Gretsch won't make you sound like George, you know? And and using the compressor that somebody uses that you just love their work isn't going to make you sound like that person because you're not that person and you might not have the experience or the truth table in your head that that person has built up over years of doing it wrong until they figured out how to do it right, you know? And I do a lot of things wrong, so I know how that works. But one of the things that you read about, now, I have nothing against marketers, but oh my God, everybody has to earn a living. But you know, I just hate it when I read about tube warmth, you know, because tubes aren't always warm, you know? Just because you put a tube in a circuit doesn't mean the circuit is designed properly for that tube. And just because you don't have a tube in that circuit doesn't mean that it must be cold because it doesn't have tubes. That's just drivel.
Right.
Or rubbish, as they say. So in terms of how that relates to compressors, yeah, there are some great compressors out there that have tubes in them, but there are some great compressors that don't.
Yep.
And we've already talked about the fact that hardware and plugins sound a bit different from each other because nothing's perfect in the world.
Sure.
So nobody that I know of has ever said, oh, I don't like this record because I could tell they used plugins, you know.
No.
Right? And I've said that before, but getting back to compression, different boxes sound different and are good for different things because no one box is perfect for everything. So for example, on vocals, an LA-2A, which is a, in hardware, is a tube compressor designed, you know, back in the Pleistocene era, you know, is a great sounding box. I have not found a software plugin that sounds just like this thing. Yes.
I just want to jump in. I thought the LA-2A was an opto compressor.
It is.
So that's not tube, isn't it?
No, it has a tube in it. It uses tube electronics, but it has an opto coupler in there. You know, you got a photocell that lights up, and you have a photoresistor that changes its value when there's a light on it. And that's what they use for the level detector.
Yep.
But the audio is going through a tube circuit, you know.
Okay. Right.
So there's a transistor version of that, a non-tube version, which is the LA-3A, which is also a good box. I prefer the LA-2A, but to each his own.
So just to back up, the LA-3A still uses a photocell and a light-based level detection, but everything after that is transistor-based, not tube-based. Is that correct?
That is my understanding.
Right.
I haven't climbed inside of an LA-3A.
Right.
You know, but I have climbed inside of an LA-2A, and I have a couple of them laying around. So in any event, the attack and release time, which is something we need to talk about on one of these podcasts, really, it's so mellow on an LA-2A. You can barely hear the thing work. It's just so good, you know. It takes like a week for the attack time to fully come back to unity gain. But
yeah,
I would just like to start off just by saying, getting back to where I started, be careful of the marketing out there and don't assume that if something doesn't have a tube, it's not warm. That's just bull, you know? Mm-hmm. It's really important who designs that circuit and how it's designed and how good they are at that and how picky they are. And it's just not true that, in my opinion, that you have to have a tube to be warm, and if you don't have a tube, you're cold. But having said that, tubes do have their thing, and I like it, you know, when when it's appropriate. But let me give you an example. So George Massenberg makes, you know, GML Labs. He makes a great, everything he makes is great because, you know, the guy's really good. Nice guy, too. But
yes,
there's no tubes in his stuff.
Right.
But sounds great. You know, sounds great. Doesn't have to have a tube in it. So there's that. So, well, again, to summarize, it's how it's designed more than what exact part it has in it. Having said that, I talked about level detection earlier, you know, and some compressors and or limiters, which a limiter is just a compressor with a larger ratio.
Yep.
There is peak detection for the level detector, and there's RMS or average level detection, and those act differently than each other. Because, for example, an 1176, which is, you know, totally a classic, and I use one of those all the time, but that's a peak detector circuit, and as such, it has a really fast attack time, just blazing fast. It'll definitely shave the hair off your snare drum if you're not careful. You know. On the other hand, you can also make it have a slow attack times, you know, like a few milliseconds, so you can let the transient of the snare through before it clamps down.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you've got DBX over easy compressors that are not peak level detection. They're more of an RMS / average level detection, and those act differently. I think George's has a crest factor knob on it, which adjusts it between peak and average so you can get anything you want out of it. I just love I just love that box. I don't have one, but I wish I did.
Yeah.
And for a while, this stuff was being manufactured by Manly Labs, which is a big tube company. And yet Yeah. I don't think they are anymore. But, you know, Manly's another company that's very quality conscious and very picky about things being right. And, you know, more power to them. And I always thought that that was a great combination. I don't know if that, I think that that's not happening anymore. But
I honestly think that 30 years from now, the things like the Voxbox will be, you know, modern day classics in the way we look back at things like LA-2As and 1176s.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. Manly makes some great mics too. But getting back, George's stuff is not tubes. And yet Manly's big thing is tubes. So, but beyond tubes and not tubes, it's about quality.
Yep.
Yeah. So, So you've got different types of level detection. And then on top of that, you've got attack and release and ratio and gain makeup controls. And knowing how to use these things can totally change how a compressor works or doesn't work.
That's right. Yeah.
So we haven't got into, I'm still just glossing over stuff, but one of the things that, and I've said this before, I think I said it last podcast, that compression is so important. And I mentioned Mike Chapman, you know, who's just so good. But
yeah,
the point being is that compression can be hard to hear at first when you're learning how to use it.
Oh,
and so it's
definitely
easy to use. Yeah. And it's easy to use too much. Right. And yeah. I've said that before, too. I keep repeating myself. Maybe I need more RAM in my head. But but I just tell people to use too much at first when you're learning how it works so that you can get an idea of how it sounds. But after a while, you can hear a half dB easy. Yeah. You could just barely, even without the meter moving, you can hear it after a while, you know.
Yeah.
So there's all these different things.
I think when you're starting out, your best approach is to wind everything up to extreme levels and then hit the bypass, because that will really make it jump out as to what the compressor is doing to your signal.
Yeah.
You know, if you've wound the ratio up pretty high and you've brought that threshold right down so that the compressor is acting on more of the signal, and you set it for a short attack and a short release so it's pumping like crazy, you're hitting the bypass in and out on the entire unit so that you're getting fully compressed and then completely uncompressed, will certainly help, you know, the novice listener start to hone in on what it is that the compressor is doing. And then you start to back those things off and you start to gain an appreciation for, you know, the subtleties of compression done, you know, subtly.
Right. Or another way to do it is to take something with transients. Like I mentioned a snare drum earlier. You know, if you put an 1176 on a snare drum, whether it be a plug-in or hardware, and you have it squashing it pretty good and you put a fast attack time on it, it'll get rid of the snare transient and totally yes. change the sound of the snare. So definitely. If you have a really fast attack time and a slower release time, it can make the snare envelope almost go backwards.
Yeah.
And that's pretty obvious. And it can be a good sound to make a compressor pump intentionally with the tempo of the music, for example, for dance music and things like that.
Sure.
Go ahead.
What I was going to say was that, yes, if you've got a snare that is particularly dead, then having an attack time, which is quite, you know what, we're getting into all this stuff, and we really haven't described what all of these settings do. So we probably should just backtrack a little bit.
Okay.
Threshold. Threshold control on a compressor determines the level at which the compression circuit will start to become active on an incoming signal. So with a compressor, if you started with the threshold at zero, that would essentially mean that what's coming in is what's going out, and no compression is being applied at all. If you dial that threshold back to, say, minus 10, then all of the signal which is below minus 10 at the input stage will come out of the output stage of that compressor at exactly the same level it went in. But anything above minus 10 dB is going to get compressed. How much it gets compressed will be determined by the other parameters on the compressor, which we will get to.
Yeah.
If you then dial that threshold down to minus 20, everything below minus 20 will come out below minus 20 at the output stage, but everything above minus 20, again, will then get compressed according to the other settings on the compressor. And so the output will change relative to the input for only signals above the threshold. Anything you want to add to threshold on that point, Doc?
Well, threshold, I always thought threshold was the Moody Blues record company, but, you know. okay, so I would just say that you could slide right over and talk about the attack time, because
yep.
when you cross threshold, it actually will wait for the amount of attack time that you have set before it does it. What the threshold is telling it to do. So if you have a fast attack time, very fast, like an infinitely fast attack time. The minute it crosses threshold, it's going to start lowering the level on the output. But that's if right. the attack yeah. time is set to delay 5 milliseconds, then once it crosses threshold, it's not going to do anything until 5 milliseconds goes by. Yeah. And that is a very handy thing. So I know we don't want to jump ahead, but let me just jump ahead for those who might be nodding off. People say that compression can bring out a sound and make it sound louder, have more apparent loudness. That's the term. Mm-hmm. How is that possible if when you cross threshold, it's turning everything down? How can it possibly even make anything louder? I know there are people out there that have that question, and I have the answer. So yep. I'm just going to jump ahead to it. Let's suppose I want a snare drum to sound bigger and fatter, and I want the envelope of the snare drum to be a little longer so that I can do that. What I would do is I would look into my workstation and see how long the transient time is. Let's just say it's 3 milliseconds, just mm-hmm. say. Well, I would set, if I put a limiter or compressor on it, I'd set it so that it didn't do anything until after the transient. So if I have a 3 millisecond transient, I set the attack for 3 milliseconds. So the transient gets through the compressor without being squashed, and then the compressor starts to squash. But instead of turning it down, what happens is I crank up the makeup gain so it brings up what is being squashed, and I set it so it's as loud as the original transient. It's the makeup gain that makes that happen, and now I've got a longer envelope on the snare drum, and it sounds fatter. Aha, that's how you do it.
Okay, there's one thing I want to throw in there. It would be important to know that the design of the compressor in question is only applying makeup gain whilst the compression circuit is active. Because if that makeup gain is constant, then that would change that analogy.
Right. My whole theory would go out the window if that was the case.
So are there compressors that are designed so that the makeup gain only works during, you know, the compressor's activity, and that once it is inactive, the makeup gain is not operational?
You know, I've never run into a compressor where the makeup gain was just always on.
Right.
Okay. I haven't.
Good to know.
Have you?
I don't know. I'd never actually considered the idea that there were two possible variations until you mentioned what you just mentioned.
Yeah.
And that just suddenly came to my mind. It's like, oh, hang on. That would depend on whether or not it was constant or only during, you know, moments of activity of the compression circuit.
Well, but it works for me. It works for me, so I assume it's working.
Right? Awesome. Yeah. Okay, so attack time, as Doc said, is the time that it takes for the compression circuit to become fully active after the signal has breached whatever threshold you've set.
Yep.
So if you've set a threshold of minus 10 and you've set an attack time of, you know, 5 milliseconds, then signal breaches that threshold and another 5 milliseconds will go by before the compression reaches the full ratio according to whatever ratio you've set. Yeah. Now, let's talk about ratio. Ratio refers to how much compression happens to that signal which has met all of the other conditions, i.e. it's louder than the threshold and comes after whatever attack time has been set. And ratio is always expressed as a number, x, to 1. And what that number represents is the dB range, like the dynamic range, after compression as opposed to, well, sorry, it's actually before compression to after compression. So if you set a ratio of 5 to 1, if you've got 5 dB of dynamic range above the threshold of the signal coming into the compressor, then what comes out of the compressor will only go 1 dB above the threshold. If you've set a threshold of minus 10, and let's say your input actually goes all the way to 0, so you've got 10 dB of signal that's actually being acted on by the compressor, and you've set a 5 to 1 ratio, then the output will be minus 8 because there were two lots of 5 dB coming in above the threshold that got compressed at 5 to 1. And so the output will be 2 dB higher than the threshold, which was minus 10.
Right.
Does that make sense? Am I making that too technical?
No, I think that's, you know, obviously it's totally correct. And I just think once in a while you have to explain things exactly as they are, you know.
Yeah.
And that's all good until soft knee happens.
Exactly. So let's talk about the knee. You will see some compressors talk about soft knee and some talk about a hard knee. Do you want to take this one, Doc?
Well, I never have any opinions about anything. you know, most DBX compressors that I've ever seen have a soft knee, which means when you go over a threshold, the ratio doesn't immediately go to whatever you have it set at. Say you have it set at 8 to 1. What happens with soft knee is it first goes a little bit to 1 to 5 to 1, and then 2 to 1, and then 4 to 1, then 6 to 1. It slowly gets to the threshold. After the threshold, it slowly gets to the ratio that you have set. And a lot of people like that because they feel it makes the compressor less apparent sounding when it's working, you know?
Yeah.
I actually prefer a hard knee. I never use soft knees.
Right.
But that's just me. Plenty of people do, and that's great, you know? People I admire use that. I just don't use it myself. So DBX-160s are great at that.
So what's interesting about this is the first couple of technologies invented, you know, way, way, way back, you know, 70 odd years ago now, were optocompressors, which, as we mentioned earlier, use a light cell to gauge the amplitude of the incoming signal. So the hotter the signal was coming in, the brighter this light would glow inside the compressor. It actually used a light bulb. And so the hotter the incoming signal, the more that light would glow. And then there was a photo cell which detected the amount of light being emitted by this light globe. And that photo cell would then dictate how much compression occurred to the incoming signal. Even though light travels faster than sound, there was an inherent lag in how quickly the light globe could light up to full intensity and how quickly it would drop off its, you know, emitting of photons back to a state of rest once level had declined. And so that lag made for very subtle musical compression. So that's opto compressors. The other early technology is what was known as a Vari-Mu design. And a Vari-Mu compressor was based on tubes as well. And what's interesting about Vari-Mu, and the reason I brought this up was because Doc was just talking about soft knee and hard knee. A Vari-Mu compressor, just by virtue of its design, does not have a ratio control. And the reason it doesn't is because the ratio of compression increases according to how hard you drive the signal into it. So by definition, a Vari-Mu compressor has a soft knee and it doesn't have any other way of operating. That's exactly the way it's designed to behave. So if you only send a little bit of signal in, you know, but just hot enough to activate the circuit, then you get a very subtle amount of compression. As that input signal gets driven harder and harder, and it drives the compression circuit harder, the ratio of compression actually gets higher. So from, you know, 2 to 1 to 3 to 1 to 4 to 1 to 5 to 1, etc. And I wonder, Doc, did the whole soft knee, hard knee thing in the world of, you know, FET and VCA compressors, did that come about by engineers trying to utilize the new technology of, you know, transistors, but still maintain some of that variable ratio control that Vari-Mu compressors had in the past? Is that how it came to be?
Well, I don't really know.
Right.
But it wouldn't surprise me. You know, somebody had somebody, you know, like, it, again, at DBX, they probably looked at their, you know, David Blackmer, probably looked at the VCA and went, you know, that LA2 is awful smooth. Let's see if I can make this thing sound like that. You know, that wouldn't surprise me. That wouldn't surprise me a bit.
Yeah. Given that we now have a world of plugins that emulate tape machines, it wouldn't surprise me at all either.
Right. Right.
There's always someone trying to adapt new technology to make it sound like old technology.
And there are people designing optical controlled compressors like this that try to emulate that, or even use LEDs or faster stuff to try to get, you know, a different type of sound out of there. I know there's one company named Pendulum that makes just a great compressor limiter. I'm not sure what they use because I haven't popped the top on it, but I know there's tubes in there.
And, right.
But that's another example of the design skills of the builder.
Yeah.
You know, and definitely a lot of skills there. It wouldn't matter if they had tubes in it or not because their design level is so high. So that's just, you know, there's also this matter of taste.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Sometimes what I will do and others will do is, like on a lead vocal, I might put an LA 2 on there to warm it up a little bit because it is a warm sounding compressor. I'm not a marketing guy. But also, I might also feed it through an 1176 to shave off the peaks a little bit. And before somebody asks which one do you put first, I would say some people do it with the 1176 first and some people do it with the LA-2A first. Try it both ways, you know?
Yep. I personally have a preference for the faster responding unit to be first, simply because, as you say, you can shave off the transients first, which brings the body of the entire signal into a more controlled range, so that when you hit the slower acting unit, in Doc's example, an LA-2A, the unit isn't having to work so hard because it's not having to deal with those transients as well as the body of the signal. But as you said, Doc, it certainly comes down to personal taste.
Well, you know, I do it the way you do. I shave off the peaks first. But there are plenty of people who I have a lot of respect for who reverse the order. So what can I say?
Yeah, definitely.
That's why this is called an art and a science.
That's right. Just to jump back to attack time, talking about those two early technologies of compressor, the Opto and the Verimu, both of those, by their very design, have quite slow, and I use the term subjectively, attack times, generally measured in milliseconds. And just to clarify, a millisecond is 1/1000th of a second. Things like your FET compressors and your VCA compressors, which represent, you know, much newer technologies. I think the first FET compressors were probably mid-60s, Doc?
Oh, I'm not sure when they started with the 1176. I don't really, you know, it was back when my hair was brown and my teeth were white. You know, a long time ago.
Yeah, so your FET and your VCA compressors are capable of much faster, much shorter attack times, even measured into microseconds, which is a millionth of a second. One article I've read, which I'll put the link to in the show notes, talks about some of these compressors having attack times as short as 20 microseconds. So that is 20 one millionths of a second. So that is, for all intents and purposes, pretty much instantaneous.
Well, you can, okay, while we're talking about instantaneous, there is always the feed-forward designs, and there are plugins that delay the signal so that there's no delay.
I wanted to get to that because I'm not 100% certain myself of what is meant by feed-forward and feedback designs. So can you bring me up to speed on that, Doc?
Well, a standard compressor, a feedback style, takes the output of the compressor and feeds that into the gain cell. So there's kind of a lag before the compressor begins to react.
Right.
A feed-forward design doesn't. It goes straight to the gain cell, you know, immediately. They sound different.
So does that mean it has to delay the incoming signal so that the compression circuit can act fast enough?
Not necessarily. It can just go straight there at the same time it goes to hits the auto path. It also hits the level detector.
Right.
API, for example, makes a model 527, which is a 500 lunchbox compressor.
Okay.
And, you know, Google lunchbox if you want to find out what that means. But in any event, it's a great compressor in terms of being flexible because you got a button in there that will have it be feed forward or feedback, and they do sound different. And here's the irony. you would think that a feed-forward design is always going to sound more accurate. And yet, and this is probably just a sign of my advanced years, I like the sound of feedback more than feed-forward most of the time. I'm sure there are plenty of people that disagree with me, because that lag means that you take the level detection input from the output of the compressor. That little delay that it takes to do that, I actually like it. So it's crazy. And then the other issue is that thing I said where a lot of plugins will delay the output signal so that it can catch up to any delay that it takes to make the thing work. So there's no overshoot at the beginning when you go over threshold. There's no overshoot. And that is a really good thing for people who want it, but you don't have to use it.
So I think right now would be an interesting moment to ask the question, when do you compress and why do you compress? And I think, you know, it comes down to understanding the nature of the input signal. You know, is it the kind of signal that has very noticeable transient information at the beginning, like a drum hit of any description, whether it's kick or snare or toms, where you have this, you know, quite high amplitude transient at the beginning of the sound, and then the sound tapers off quite quickly to something that will sustain for, you know, varying periods of time, depending on what the type of drum is, to vocals, which are completely variable. There are parts of vocals that are very transient, you know, things like your T sounds and K sounds, you know, have very strong transients at the beginning of them, but then the remainder of the sound might be quite rounded and drawn out. And then you get onto things like electric guitars, you know, which have been compressed already, you know, gone through fuzz boxes or whatever, that can quite often not have a whole, you know, obvious transient at the beginning. Anything you want to throw in on this, Doc?
Well, you know, most people, I think, don't realize that if you have an overdriven guitar, it's all, by its nature, is already compressed. And I've heard people say that you don't need to use a compressor in that case. And yet sometimes I find myself using one because, you know, rules be damned, right? whatever works.
I would agree with that, to the extent that it all comes down to how well the recorded signal works in the mix by itself. The guitarist in question may very well have gone through, you know, any number of pedals, you know, that are designed to saturate or distort or compress, you know, the signal coming from the pickup of the guitar. But how much he applied may not have been enough for what the final mix of the song actually requires.
Well, like, most guitar players, you know, have some, you know, unless they're classical, right, or jazz or whatever, but most rock guitar players do have some compression on in their rig.
Yeah.
And, you know, guitar players need to play with their pedals because that affects how they play. They need to hear that stuff. And you can't just go direct and expect to add it all later and have it work because, you know, having them hear that when they play affects how they play, of course.
Yeah.
But one thing you said earlier takes me back in time. I remember when Solid State Logic first came out and made the big splash with their mixing consoles, and they had a compressor on every channel. And I think they were the first mass-produced console that did that. And so the records that you heard after that, that were coming out of the big studios about SSLs, everybody just compressed the snot out of every track because they just could not keep their hands off those knobs and buttons. They just couldn't do it. And one of the things that happens with compression is compression can sound really great at first, but after a while it makes a signal sound like it's yelling at you and it can become irritating. Just listen to any television commercial, for example.
Definitely.
So I think some of those early records are good examples of what happens when, well, everybody tries the new toy when it comes out, but some of those early records are just really irritating because they're just so compressed all the time.
Yeah.
Because when you compress something and then you bring up the makeup gain to get your level back, you end up bringing up all the soft stuff, and that what makes the compression work. That's why it sounds bigger. But inside that soft stuff might be things that you don't like intermodulation distortion and amplifier hiss and just noise, because noise is proportional to gain, you know, all this stuff. So louder is not always better. Now, you asked, when is a good time to use compression? Well, I can tell you one time that often is important. One of the things that often distinguishes an amateur night mix or recording from something that's more professional sounding is when the lead vocal is really soft and then really loud and you can't hear the breathing that makes it sound intimate, and then all of a sudden they're screaming at you. Yep. So judicious compression can help there and lower your dynamic range so you can set the vocal in the pocket, as it were, and have it sit in the mix where it needs to sit.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, I'm not talking about Pavarotti, okay? I'm talking about pop music.
Yeah. Now, that raises an interesting point, you know, in relation to working with vocal, that depending on the nature of the song, it's not uncommon to have a vocal which can be soft in parts and much louder in other parts of the same song. And that can create quite a conundrum for the mixing engineer, particularly if they're new to all of this and don't quite understand how to make that work. What I have said in the past is set up in whatever way you have to do it according to the DAW that you are working in, set up a signal path which allows you to alter the level of the vocal before it hits the input to the compressor. Now, in Reaper, you have both a volume envelope for a track, but you also have a volume pre-effects envelope for the track. And the beauty of that particular envelope is that you can set a higher volume envelope for the soft parts of the vocal and a lower envelope for the louder parts of the vocal so that the entire track hits the input of the compressor at around about the same level. Now, the reason that that becomes advantageous is if you set your compressor, let's say you didn't have this volume pre-effects envelope to play with. If you then go and set a threshold for the compressor based on the softest part of the vocal, what's going to happen is that when the louder part of the vocal hits the compressor, it is absolutely going to drive that compression circuit into overdrive. Like, it's just going to go nuts. And that's not what you want. You don't want the compressor to behave differently on the louder part of the song to the way it behaves on the softer part of the song. Now, I say you don't want it, but it's all subjective. It depends on what you're trying to achieve with the mix. But 9 times out of 10, you're going to want the compression to be similar in its approach to the vocal in the soft part as well as the approach to the vocal in the loud part. Would you agree with that, Doc, or do you think there are exceptions to that?
No, I think that makes sense. You know, what I typically will do, first of all, my DAW is different than your DAW, right?
Sure.
But I would just say that, well, often what I will do is I'll set the compressor so it just compresses a little bit, and then I'll also ride the fader so I can keep the dynamic range under control, but I can do it with some, you know, hopefully legit, you know, alleged intelligence so that, you know, it stays under control.
Yeah.
That way, having a little bit of compression helps the dynamic range be under control, but then writing volume automation on it when I'm doing the mix really helps. And sometimes I'll follow the compressor with an equalizer, and then I'll follow that with another compressor, and both compressors, the one before and after the equalizer, aren't doing very much. And
right.
That sounds better than having one compressor doing a lot.
Definitely. I'd definitely agree with that.
Yeah, you do a little bit, and then you go somewhere else, then you come back and you do just a little bit more, and that can really help you keep things under control. But even then, I'm still going to ride the vocal. You know, this.
Yeah.
If people have the idea, especially in a DAW, that you just sit there and find the balances and then let it play through that, No. It's a constantly moving thing.
Now, am I right, Doc, in thinking that in Pro Tools, if you do a fader move on let's say it's a track that's got a vocal on it, that fader move is post any plugins?
It is.
Right. So,
yeah.
to achieve what except, I was talking about.
Only exception is the Master Fader. In Pro Tools, the Master Fader, the plugins are after the fader, which is why I never use Master Faders. But
right, yeah. Just to jump back to what I was talking about, you know, Reaper having this volume pre-effects envelope, to achieve the same thing in a DAW like Pro Tools, what you would do is you would set up a bus and you would put the compressor on the bus. And then that way you can ride the automation for the vocal track and feed that track into the bus. And that way you are getting to control the level of the vocal before it hits the input to the compressor. And then, you know, once you've done that and you've got, you know, all of the different parts of the vocal, the soft bits and the medium bits and the loud bits, all hitting the input to that bus at a sensible level so that the compressor is just doing as much as you want it to do, then you could automate the output of that bus if you then needed to. Does that make sense, Doc?
Well, you could do that, or you could bring that bus back into an aux fader and automate that, you know? So yeah. you could do it either way.
That's kind of what I meant.
Yeah, but what you're talking about is parallel compression. I use that a lot on drums. So, you know, because I'll bring the drums into the mix, and then I'll take a feed off of that, send it to a bus, and run that to an aux fader, stick a plug-in in there that'll just crush it, and then fade just a little bit in with the uncompressed drums to bring in some of that, you know, lower stuff. It helps make the drums get punchy in a hurry. And if you bring out that compression a lot, it begins to sound like Strawberry Fields, which is great.
Right. So for those who are new to the concept of parallel compression, the idea is that rather than compressing everything from the top down, which is generally the way a compressor works, right? It works on the loudest part of the signal. The idea of parallel compression is that you take the entire signal, in Doc's example, your entire drum mix, duplicate that off to an aux bus, run a compressor on that aux bus and absolutely crush the snot out of it, and then bring that output back in alongside the original signal at a low level. And so what you're doing is essentially compressing from the bottom up rather than from the top down. So you're bringing all of the low level stuff up in the mix louder, but still retaining all of the transients that were there on the unaffected drum mix. Is that a good way of explaining it?
Oh, that's great. And it's really a handy trick to use. You can use it on background vocals and other stuff as well, right?
Yeah. Andrew Sheps is a big fan of that. And I think Michael Brower is also... I think it was Michael Brower who was one of the first people to do it.
Wouldn't surprise me. I don't know Michael, but his work speaks for itself.
Right. Although you mentioned Strawberry Fields, so maybe people were doing it a long time ago. I don't know.
Well, I just think that if you put a Fairchild tube compressor on a set of drums, it's going to sound like that. And that's, I believe, what they did back then. You know, there's a book that talks about that called Recording the Beatles that you can only get at recordingthebeatles.com.
Okay.
And I really, in fact, while I'm at it, there are two books I'd like to, let me just make a left turn. And while I'm thinking of it, there's two books I'd like to recommend to the listening audience. One of them is Recording the Beatles, because it's just a fantastic book. It comes in a 2-inch tape box, an EMI tape box.
Nice.
And it's just fantastic. The two guys who wrote it are just great and very knowledgeable. And the book is just, you know, the benchmark. But recordingthebeatles.com, highly recommended. The other book I wanted to talk about just briefly, and I thought about this before the podcast when I was forgetting about what time it was, Mastering Audio, The Art and the Science by Bob Katz, K-A-T-Z.
Yep.
Now, but the third edition, put this in neon lights, the third edition. It just came out. The third edition has got gear porn in it that is just fantastic.
I think the copy I have is the second edition.
Yeah. Well, the third edition is just rocking.
Right.
I think it's a great
book.
Oh, anybody who cares about audio needs this book.
Yeah, definitely.
End of story. End of story. Okay, commercial's over. Okay.
Yeah.
I get no remuneration or kickback from either of these authors, by the way.
Yeah. Look, we've been going for an hour. I think we'll wrap it up here, but we will continue this discussion in the next episode, and hopefully we will get some more questions. I do have some follow-up from Theo Goodman, which we will hold over till the next episode. Theo, don't worry, I'm not ignoring you. And if anyone else wants to throw in any questions based on this episode, if you get them through to us in the next week, then we should be able to answer those questions in the follow-up episode. Anything you want to throw in as a wrap-up, Doc?
Well, I would just say that there should be a lot of questions because I'm sure we thoroughly confused everyone. So, you know, questions are good. We jumped around a bit because, you know, I can't think in a straight line, so that's fine. But having said that, thanks, everybody, and ta-ta, right?
All right, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, Doc.
Okay, bye-bye.
Sign Language. Another audiotoyou.com quality podcast. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@signlanguagepodcast.com.